This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran categorically rejects a Western media report about enriching uranium to levels above 60%, saying the report seeks to distort the realities. North Korea fires warm ballistic missiles in response to the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula and its joint military drills with the South. Also ahead, Moscow says the West shows no willingness to peacefully resolve the conflict in Ukraine as NATO allies push for more weapons for Kiev. Welcome. Our top story, Iran has rejected a report by the news website Bloomberg claiming inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency have found enriched uranium beyond permitted levels. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behrouz Kamalvandi, said it is regrettable the UN nuclear watchdog is being used as a political lever to put pressure on Tehran. He added Bloomberg's report is aimed at distorting the realities. The spokesman said the existence of uranium particles with over 60% purity level during the enrichment process does not mean uranium has been enriched at that level. What matters, he said, is the end product, adding Iran has never enriched uranium to purity levels of more than 60%. In its report, Bloomberg claimed that IAEA inspectors had discovered Iran enriched uranium with a purity level of 84%. The 59th annual Munich Security Conference has wrapped up. Unlike previous years, Germany did not invite any representative from Tehran, but instead chose to give the limelight to unelected anti-Iran individuals with no mandate other than from Western media and politicians.
The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, three notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The three anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change.
Ali Nejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Ali Nejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Today marks the 15th day of the hunger strike by a senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the resistance movement held in an Israeli jail. To discuss that further, we were joined by our guests earlier in this program. Let's see what they had to say.
Stay tuned for this edition of the News Review. It's the 15th day of a hunger strike by a senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement held in an Israeli jail. Qadr Adnan is protesting against the extension of solitary confinement. The 44-year-old was arrested during a raid on his home near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. He's been arrested 12 times and spent nearly 8 years behind bars. More than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Hamas's movement has vowed to continue its support for the Palestinians in prisons. Hamas says the Tel Aviv regime is subjecting the detainees to the most brutal forms of abuse. Israel has recently stepped up its crackdown. In protest of atrocities, the Palestinians have launched a general strike in the occupied Al Quds and several West Bank cities. Okay, now let's call in our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, and ask her more about this. Mona, good to have you with us. So tell us about the situation in general of the Palestinians held in Israeli jails, what's going on there, and this specific case in point, Adnan.
Well, speaking in general about Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails, we are speaking today about over 4,500 Palestinians held in a number of Israeli jails in very difficult situation and under inhumane conditions. We also speak about hundreds of Palestinians who are kept behind bars without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention that is illegal. This administrative detention allows the Israeli authorities to keep Palestinians behind bars for indefinite periods of time without telling the lawyers and the prisoners themselves why in the first place those Palestinians had been arrested. They claim, the Israelis, of course, continue to claim that they have secret information that allows the Israelis to keep Palestinians behind bars without telling the lawyers what are these reasons. But human rights organizations and prisoners groups say that it's another tool by the Israeli authorities to keep holding Palestinians, punishing them for any form of resistance, for expressing their point of view, for rejecting the Israeli occupation and their first place. Anyway, the Israelis have arrested Khadr Adnan on the 5th of this month from his hometown, Arabi, in Jenin. And the moment he was arrested, he immediately heard that he starts an upended hunger strike. Because speaking about Khadr Adnan, the senior leader of the jihad movement, Khadr Adnan has been arrested by the Israelis at least 11 times in the past, and he was engaged in a number of hunger strikes against the illegal detention, the so-called administrative detention. This time, the Israelis had been extending his arrest, claiming that he's under arrest to continue the interrogations against him. But Khadr Adnan knows very well that at the end of the day, there are no clear charges against him. The Israelis would be holding him under the so-called administrative detention. And because he declared an open-ended hunger strike, the Israeli jailers put him in solitary confinement. As you have said, for 15 days, he had been refusing food. He had been in an open-ended hunger strike. We have to mention that Khadr Adnan, of course, seen by many Palestinian prisoners as a symbol for starting the hunger strike. In 2004, he continued the hunger strike that lasted for 25 days. In 2012, his hunger strike lasted for 67 days, and these hunger strikes were to pressurize the Israeli prison authorities to either release him or prosecute him, but not to keep him behind bars without charge or trial.
Okay. Now, Mazen Gomsia, a Palestinian scientist and author, is also joining me from Bethlehem. Good to have you with us, sir. So, Mazen, tell us about, in the first place, as Mona put it, administrative detention itself, you know, it's questionable. You don't know what charges are leveled against you. You're held for whatever period they want to. And then, apart from that, we have lots of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Doesn't the Tel Aviv regime have this responsibility as an occupation force? Don't they have any functions or responsibilities when it comes to the health condition of the people that they are holding behind bars? Because we hear reports of torture, we hear lots of limitations, against them. They are not allowed to visit their families, so they are going on hunger strike. Sometimes they have no access to lawyers either.
Yes, over the past 76 years since the foundation of the State of Israel, basically over 1 million Palestinians spent some time in Israeli gulags. And I hate to use the word prisons because they are really not appropriate in such terminology. Israel, as an occupying army, is obligated under international law to respect things like the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Fourth Geneva Convention, for example, prohibits the occupying force from torturing and otherwise mistreating what's referred to in international law as protected people, civilians under occupation. And the fact that civilians resist also occupation is not an excuse to do collective punishment, which Israel does, or to transfer its own population into occupied territories and take some of the existing population and put it in gulags inside the Green Line. This is not acceptable under international law, and certainly the process of administrative detention is also not acceptable under international law.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mona Candila, correspondent, Ramallah, Mazen Gomsia, Palestinian scientist and author in Bethlehem.
Moving on, North Korea has launched more projectiles a day after firing an intercontinental ballistic missile that landed off Japan's coast. The South Korean and Japanese militaries say the two short-range ballistic missiles were fired within minutes of each other early Monday. They reportedly landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. The launch comes a day after a joint U.S.-South Korea military drills. In response, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warned against increased U.S. presence in the region. She said the North could turn the Pacific into a, quote, firing range, depending on U.S. forces' movements. Tensions are running high on the Korean Peninsula as the North views America's war games with its regional allies as provocative and rehearsals for an invasion. Moscow says the United States is a, quote, major provocateur of international tensions after Washington expressed support for Ukraine's attack on Russian-annexed Crimea. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the remarks by American officials about Crimea underscored the depth of disagreements between the two countries. He was responding to the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland, who had also called for Crimea to be demilitarized. Peskov added that Kiev and its Western allies have not shown any willingness to peacefully resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Russia says Western countries are prolonging the war in Ukraine by pouring military aid into the country. The West, however, has ignored the warning. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has been urging Western countries to provide more military aid to Ukraine.
The Zelensky and the Ukrainians have a lot of applaudissement and not enough ammunition. That's the paradox. They need to be less applauded and better supplied with arms. The Ukrainians are fighting, paying the highest price in terms of lives, but this war happens in European soil, affects us, and has a global impact around the world, which also affects our security.
Borrell made the comments at the Munich Security Conference. There, Ukrainian officials urged U.S. Congress members to press the administration of President Joe Biden to send F-16 fighter jets to Kiev. Ukraine says the jets would boost Kiev's ability to hit Russian missile units. Washington has been reluctant to send the warplanes, but the proposal is supported by Congress. The U.S. has provided at least $30 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the war in February last year. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
In the United States, black people have the highest rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality across all racial and ethnic groups for which data were available, and experienced the largest increase in maternal mortality when compared to pre-pandemic levels. The underlying inequalities in health and healthcare for black people also contributed to disparities in COVID-19, with black people facing a higher risk of hospitalization and death due to COVID-19 compared with white people. Moreover, the unequal effects of COVID-19 may lead to widening disparities in health going forward. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, a black infant is many times more likely to die within 1 year of birth than a white infant is, even if that black infant comes from a wealthy home, a new study shows. The study, which was published by the National Bureau of Economic Research last month, demonstrates that disparities in black and white infant mortality rates cannot be explained by economics alone. Rather, racism within the healthcare industry, both overt and institutional, appears to play a significant role in such outcomes. The study conducted in California from 2007 to 2016 examined mortality rates for infants within their first year of life. It is being heralded as the first of its kind to measure disparities in infant mortality rates between black and white families in conjunction with tax data. The U.S. overall infant mortality rate is devastatingly high compared to other wealthy countries, and outcomes for black families in the U.S. are far worse than to white families, the study shows. Among the children who were born to the wealthiest white parents in the study, 173 died within their first year for every 100,000 births. Among white parents with low incomes, 350 infants died for every 100,000 births. Babies born to white parents with low incomes still had higher survival rates than babies born to the wealthiest of black parents, who experienced 437 infant deaths for every 100,000 births, according to the study. Outcomes were even worse for black parents with low incomes, with an infant mortality rate of 653 infants for every 100,000 births. The data suggests that the well-documented black-white gap in infant and maternal health that's been discussed a lot in recent years is not just explained by differences in economic circumstances. It suggests it's much more structural. Maya Rosin-Slater, an author of the study and an economist who specializes in health policy at Stanford, said to New York Times, "It's not race, it's racism." University of Wisconsin-Madison public health economist Tiffany L. Green, who was not involved in the study, said of its results, adding, "The data are quite clear that this isn't about biology. This is about the environments where we live in, where we work, where we play, where we sleep." Notably, the U.S. is the only wealthy country without universal health care and is one of the only countries in the world without guaranteed paid family leave. As Times reported, there are many documented examples proving that racism exists in the U.S. healthcare system. While the country's infant mortality rate is gradually decreasing each year, disparities between black and white patients remain. There are also disparities in the treatment of black and white people who give birth. In an op-ed for Truth Out in 2018, parenting and health author Rochon Meadows Fernandez detailed her experiences with racism in U.S. healthcare system after giving birth to her son. Though she had passed several blood clots and felt extreme pain whenever she tried to walk, physicians repeatedly told Meadows Fernandez that what she was experiencing was normal, with some telling her after tests following her pregnancy that everything looked fine. After a month of inaction by her doctors, a physician finally listened to her complaints, eventually discovering that a piece of placenta was still inside her uterus. Meadows Fernandez wrote, "All of a sudden, the medical establishment acknowledged the dangers of the situation I was facing, increased risk for hemorrhaging, infection, and even death. Even then, physicians continued to ignore other health conditions she was suffering from, dismissing them as regular symptoms after childbirth. Her treatment was largely the result of systematic racism," Meadows Fernandez said. "The lack of cultural competence is so vast within U.S. medical system that there are still professionals who believe black people have higher pain tolerance than people of other races," Meadows Fernandez said, adding, "It is also likely that, like me, other black women have also sought assistance only to be turned away due to false perceptions of black women's fertility or left uncomfortable after being subjected to embarrassment via interrogation. My experiences have shown me just a couple of the many ways in which the reproductive health system ostracizes black women," she added, saying, "It is especially important that black women have access to quality reproductive care because all too often our very lives are at stake." Also, according to the website of Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF, while black people have made great contributions and achievements in the United States, they continue to face many health and healthcare disparities that adversely impact their overall health and well-being. These disparities have been exacerbated by the uneven impacts of the COVID pandemic, ongoing racism and discrimination, and police violence against and killings of black people. Moreover, the long history of inequitable health outcomes among black people reflects the abuses faced during slavery, segregation, mass incarceration, and their persistent legacies. Black people face increased barriers to accessing and utilizing health care. Black people are more likely to report financial barriers to receiving health care. While the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and pandemic-era policies have helped narrow some disparities in health coverage, non-elderly black people, 11%, continue to have a higher uninsured rate than their white peers, 7%. Further, compared to white people, black people are more likely to face social and economic challenges that adversely impact health, including higher rates of poverty and food insecurity. Black adults are also more likely than white adults and to report being treated unfairly because of their race, ethnicity, while seeking care for themselves or family members.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to The Viewpoint. I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And today with me, I have two dear guests, experts of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Brother, and assalamu alaikum, brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me once again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me to have you here with me. So, as you know, in modern world, we are living in a virtual, actually, area, which, I don't know, sometimes we feel like we are drowning into that. As you know, today, no matter what we do, no matter how we struggle not to be connected to this virtual world, still there is social media in our lives. So, you know, I'm talking about the solitude that we actually feel when we have connection, but after losing all these connections, we feel like grading ourselves to have more connections with others. But I don't know, there are many reasons that there are some obstacles that we cannot do that. And after these, we feel depressed. Of this, I don't know, so-called solitude. Maybe it's not solitude, it's loneliness or whatever you call it. Yeah. But I'm talking about that sort of
things. Yeah, yeah, let me reach that. I wanted to reach to that point again. Look, yes, we told you solitude by itself is not a bad thing because we have been asked and told to have a state of solitude in a day, let's say for 3 minutes, let's say, so to just to think and ponder on your own affairs and your own issues. But when this solitude is going to lose its identity and become something which is dangerous, this is something that should be controlled. Like, for example, you are getting isolated from your own family and you are going to, for example, work and talk with others. So which is more preferable for you, to be with your mother, to talk with your dad, and to talk with your siblings? But the time that you have to dedicate to them, you are going to dedicate it with and pass it and spend it with others who have no value even in your life.
No, I do not agree with that part.
I mean, it can happen with those that have no value and status in your life.
Exactly. There are priorities.
But the value of the parents and the siblings should not be underestimated. The same way we estimate the time for, we give the time, quality time for our friends, our virtual friends.
Of course.
So,
yeah.
Exactly. This is the point that we are expecting ourselves and, let's say, the leadership of the society to work on the management of our time that we are spending on cyberspace.
Yeah.
So we have to think on these issues. How can I spend my time so that I do not violate the rights, my own personal rights and the rights of others who are around me? So we have to think and ponder, yes, this is a facility at my hand and I have to take best use of it. So I have to manage my time, the time that I'm going to spend in it. So this point is very important. We have to increase our media literacy to see where and how to enter and to go and to visit and to check in the cyberspace, in the web in general. So I want to say at the same time that it has its own challenges, it has its own risk, but it might have some benefits. We have to try our best to take benefit from what is there.
Yeah. Yeah, I do agree with whatever you told up to here. But, you know, sometimes you want your priority to be the virtual world. I mean, you're telling me that I have to manage my time. What is the reason? Why should I do that? When I enjoy it, when I go through these social, medias, more than being with my family, so I choose it.
Look, we have to look at the purpose of life. If the life is just to actually have and create and have enjoyments, that's okay. We can continue with that. If we have defined a goal in our life, and for example, if we are actually respecting the religious values, or specifically in the Islam world, Islamic values, so we have been created.
No, you're telling me cliches. Look, you know, for example, I have 24 hours a day,
and as far as I'm enjoying myself, that's okay for me. So it's not.
So, no, I'm telling you that, for example, I have 5 hours for communicating with other people a day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, from these 5 hours, I am who decides, which part of this amount I have to share with other people and to whom I'm sharing this time. I'm telling you that it has nothing to do with the goal of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I have, 19 hours left here for working on the goal of my life, or working, whatever I have to do in this life, money, financial success, and so on. And the rest of time I have, I want to share it.
Definitely,
like
you can you can enjoy your life. I mean, in case you think that this enjoyment is good, and I mean enjoyment in the right sense, it's okay. You can spend it with
yourself. So it's okay.
I told you, because if you have already thought about the challenges and risk of that, and if you think that the places that you are visiting or the people that you are contacting are safe enough, so don't worry. No worries. No, you have no worry then.
Thank
so
you.
Let me pose another question, because I think it's going to be in line with the thing that Brother Ali was saying. This 5 hours that you have, and you've decided on sharing time, but it's your decision on who you want to share. What is the criteria that you use to decide on who you want to share with? Your friends and family and so on? Are you going to give it to the virtual space, or are you going to give it to your family? What makes you decide between these two? So that comes back to the same purpose of life. Yeah. Do you get the point, right? That 5 hours that you have allocated for your social space, right? Whether it be virtual, whether it be physical, it still gets back to your purpose of life and what your life is. Your life, is it more valuable if you spend time with your virtual friends, or is it more valuable if you spend time with your family?
So I think,
right?
It's not
physically speaking, again.
I got you. I think it's not a matter of value. It's the matter of similarities. You know, when you have a lot of things in common with other people, mm-hmm. you want to go through them. You want to talk to them. You want to communicate with them, you know? And this is exactly what will happen when I want to choose between my family and some virtual persons. When I feel like I show a personality in virtual world that has many supporters, you know, that there are people who are telling me, okay, you are great. You are amazing. I don't know. So, and so on. I tend to show my personality in these areas rather being the family, you know.
It's fine. You can have an impression with your friends in your social media and stuff. The point of discussion is how should you balance this, right? That's the main question.
Yeah, exactly.
So you must the issue, I think, the thread that began is managing your time, right? So in this 5 hours that you have that you've allocated for the social time, how should you manage it and how should you balance it? One thing is, yes, of course, you have to spend time with your friends, try to find your, you know, similarity circles and get these people around you. But at the same time, should you devalue the time that you have with your family? No. Balance it. Have time with your parents.
And even this 5 hours that you have available, so if you're spending on the virtual space, then I think the time, the enjoyment that you might have from the physical space, I mean, the real space has been lost already. So we have to think, no problem, you can continue with that, but you have to at least have it in part of your mind that, okay, I'm losing another, actually, potentiality, something which is actually benefiting me even from the physical part of my body.
Boils down to the fact that you should balance it. Don't overdo any of the aspect. Don't be too physical and forget about the virtual world, because virtual world is right now reality, to be honest. You get access to information and you get connected to people that you weren't able to previously. That was impossible previous. But at the same time, should you just indulge into this and forget about the rest of the life? No. There's, like, for example, this new platform that came from Facebook, Metaverse. Now, that's something that I personally would be against, because you're even augmenting the entire reality into a virtual life.
Yeah.
That's like, conceptually, it's something that I wouldn't agree upon. Now, social media, yes, but like this augmented reality, making this entire reality into something virtual, that's conceptually something to disagree upon.
So you told something which is really beautiful around, you know, you told virtual world is reality.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when, for example, I spend the whole 5 hours of, I don't know, the time I have to communicate with other people in the social media, I feel like, I don't know, a kind of depression, I can call it. I don't know, what is it? I want you to share your ideas with me about the point that, is it because this is virtual world? I mean, it is, I don't know, feeling of depression. The reason of feeling this depression is because of this virtual world, because it is not a physical
Conceptually, no. Not if you look at the virtual world itself, it's not necessarily the virtual world that's causing you that. It's the content of the virtual world, because there are many people who are very happy dealing with virtual friends because they have clear-cut boundaries. They know their similarities and they know which friends they should choose. There are friends in social media, just like in the physical world, that are not necessarily good ones. They're also ones. It all comes back to the fact that how social media influences our personality.
So are you sure about that? People don't fake their happiness in social media.
Because
this is the nature of human being, you know.
Yeah.
We need being physical, I think.
It's like, you see, the thing, the same way people can fake their personality and their emotions in the physical world, they can do it even better in the virtual world.
Exactly.
Because with the physical world, you can see the body language. One way or the other, you'll be able to understand that person is faking or not. But in the virtual world, the only thing you're faced with is either a picture or a text or some form of a multimedia, which makes it a bit difficult to understand whether the person is faking or not. But I'm not talking about faking and how this faking would affect. I'm talking about the actual influences that this virtual world, this social media has on your personality, making you feel insecure. For example, those especially those who take selfies, they're the selfieists, I would call them. Like, you would be surprised at the trend. If you look at their first selfie and the selfie that they're taking now, let's say for example a span of 5 years, you'd be surprised the changes they went through.
Exactly.
Their hairstyle, their makeup, the way they pose, everything, just because of the comments and likes. They felt that if they pose like this, it's going to be better, and not like that, they get more likes. Comments, oh, your hair looks like that, your hair should look like this. You feel insecure about your own personality. You're not you anymore. You're enslaved to the comments and the likes that you get in the social media. That's why I mentioned there are specific niches of social media. And conceptually, some of these niches should be disagreed upon. For example, TikTok, I definitely disagree upon on any time of the day. Because it's a niche that it's completely destroying the culture, the culture fabric of the society. But like things like LinkedIn or other social, like personal peer-to-peer social medias, they're like tools. You can communicate easily with your colleagues and peers without feeling insecure unless you know that person itself. Unless you don't know that person, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Because people can also make you feel insecure in WhatsApp and other, you know, peer-to-peer social media as well.
One of
the reasons that you might actually be in a state of depression and anxiety is that you are sure that the people who are around you in this environment are not the real people. At least not all of them, but at least, let's say, for example, at least 20% of them. So when you actually enter this environment with this mentality and mindset that, this person that I'm talking about, does he actually exist virtually? I mean, in reality? Does he exist in reality? So this is that you actually are in a state of doubt that if he exists or he does not exist. I mean, this if you collect all these facts and actually collect all of them together, you will face a sort of, a chaos inside yourself that whom am I talking about? Whom am I spending the time with?
Yeah.
If the person that I'm talking, for example, to for years... it is a boy, but in reality, he might be a girl on the other side.
It happened to me.
You see?
So tell me about the stories I heard about these.
Yeah.
There was a boy, but then in reality, it was a girl.
Yeah. So we see that. So this is something that it doesn't let you to be tranquil and calm. So all in all, we want to say that everything should be spent. I mean, the time should be spent between all the affairs that all issues that we have equally in the amount that they are really needed. I mean, the time that we need to pay attention to the family and to give it to family, it should be on its own place. And the time that I need to have in cyberspace with my genuine friends that I know, for example.
Yeah.
It should be there in its own place. But even the kind of contact that we are going to have with our genuine friends should sometimes happen in reality. I mean, in physical spaces, because it has its own benefits. At least you walk and you do sort of, let's say, exercise for yourself
to
go and check your friends and see your friends. So I want to say that virtual space, with all its negative points that it has lots of positive opportunities
benefits.
For us.
Of course.
So we have to look at it with this mindset that it can bring us benefits.
Yeah. Thank you for your elaboration and being here. And also, Brother Muhammad, let me have one gist from you of being happy in modern world.
Mm-hmm.
What should we do? Just, I don't know, one sentence. I think you told the answer in your conversation up to here, but...
Being happy is a very good question. And I think in one sentence I can say, personally, meditation is actually one of the best ways.
Yeah.
Staying away from having a healthy personal life, physical one, and thinking about yourself, doing calculation about yourself, doing meditation, it really brings happiness to you.
Exactly. And I think the maintaining of balance that you told... Yeah. In our speech Definitely. Was the most important thing I've learned in this discussion. So thank you, Dr. Experisiv, today's episode for being here with me. It was all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you, dear listeners. I bid you farewell, and I leave you in the warm embrace of God. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
According to reports of international human rights organizations and civil institutions in Afghanistan, since the occupation of the country by the US military and its allies in October of 2001 until the time of their chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, thousands of innocent Afghan civilians have been killed and tens of thousands more have been injured. But the American authorities have never been held accountable for their heinous crimes in the country. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered the story and tells us more. An internal military review reportedly concluded that US analysts' incorrect presumptions and prejudices contributed to the chaotic August 2021 Pentagon departure from Afghanistan and resulted in Kabul drone attack that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Tensions were running high on the day of the drone strike, just 3 days after the August 26th terrorist bombing that killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghans at Kabul airport. The probe by U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, noted that another attack by Daesh terrorists was expected that day and that intelligence reports indicated it would involve a white Toyota Corolla. The report said military analysts observed a white Toyota Corolla stopping at what they believe was a Daesh compound, so they began tracking the car. After the vehicle pulled into a gated courtyard, near the airport just hours later, a Hellfire missile strike on the car by an MQ-9 Reaper drone was ordered. Later on that day, US officials announced that they had successfully prevented another terrorist attack. As reports of civilian deaths began to surface, US officials said they had no indications of such casualties and were investigating whether a secondary explosion might have killed someone. However, CENTCOM's investigation revealed that analysts reported within 20 minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed. Within 3 hours, they had assessed that at least three Afghan children, were killed. Military officials continued to conceal what they knew about the strike. 3 days later, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said the attack was righteous and that it had killed a Daesh facilitator and unknown others. The driver of the Toyota Corolla turned out to be an aid worker who had spent the day picking up his employer's laptop, taking colleagues to and from work, and loading canisters of water into his trunk to bring home to his family. The CENTCOM investigation was completed a week and a half after a drone strike and was never released to the public. 16 months later, the US media obtained 66 partially redacted pages of the report, only after suing CENTCOM under the Freedom of Information Act. The probe detailed how biases led analysts to make tragically wrong assumptions. For instance, they concluded that a package loaded into the car containing explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route meant he was trying to evade surveillance. The New York Times has also covered the same story. According to a congressionally mandated Pentagon report, the US military, which invaded and illegally occupied Afghanistan for almost 2 decades, killed 12 Afghan civilians in 2021. The report states they were killed in a botched drone strike the American military carried out in the Afghan capital Kabul on 29th of August 2021. Just 1 day before the phased US military drawdown ended. According to a report released recently, which constitutes only a fraction of the atrocities unleashed by US occupation forces in Afghanistan, 7 of the 10 Afghan civilians killed in that incident were children. It also documents the killing of an Afghan civilian in a US strike on 8th of January in the western Herat province, and another on 11th of August in the southern Kandahar province. The botched drone strike in August of 2021 prompted a half-hearted apology from then head of the US Central Command, General Frank McKenzie, who admitted it was a mistake. However, no US military officials or troops were punished or held accountable for that deadly drone strike. The Taliban staged a stunning comeback in August of 2021, toppling the Western-backed government in Kabul and forcing the United States and its allies to abandon the country after years of futile military adventure. For 2 decades, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. governments, from George W. Bush to Joe Biden, finally ending in a botched military exit and a disgraceful defeat. It started on 29th of February 2020, when then-US President Donald Trump's administration signed an agreement with the Taliban to pull out US troops from the country by 1st of May 2021. However, the deal failed to de-escalate tensions between the two sides. On 14th of April 2021, President Joe Biden announced that the remaining 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan would be withdrawn by 11th of September to end what he called America's forever war. Between May and August of 2021, The Taliban overran several key provincial capitals across Afghanistan, which, with the beleaguered Afghan forces offering little resistance. Amid the ensuing chaos and commotion, on 29th of August 2021, a US drone strike killed 10 family members of an Afghan family, including 7 children, near the airport. In September of 2021, the Pentagon acknowledged it was a tragic mistake, but said none of the military personnel involved in the botched drone strike will face any kind of punishment. The website of NPR has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Pentagon said it would not punish the military team behind the errant drone strike that was intended to hit the masterminds of an attack on Kabul airport, but instead killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children. U.S. Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby recently confirmed reports that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin approved a series of recommendations following an investigation into the deadly incident in August of 2021. Those did not include disciplinary action for the military service members involved in what officials had called a tragic mistake. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters during a briefing, "The Secretary of Defense is now approving or calling for additional accountability measures. I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the 29th of August airstrike." Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said investigations led by General Kenneth McKenzie, who leads U.S. Central Command, and General Richard Clark, the head of the Special Operations Command, resulted in a series of recommendations for procedural changes and process improvements that need to occur and will occur, adding, "But in this particular case, there was not a strong enough case to be made for personal accountability, and no one was found criminally negligent." An investigation by the Air Force's Inspector General, Lieutenant General Sami Saeed, found the deadly mistake was the result of confirmation bias. The New York Times uncovered video footage that challenged the Pentagon's narrative that officials admitted the drone strike had been a mistake. The strike killed Zamari Ahmadi, an employee of U.S.-based Nutrition and Education International, NEI, and 9 members of his family. Last month, Nutrition and Education International founder and president Steve Kwan called the Pentagon's investigation into the incident deeply disappointing and inadequate. The Pentagon promised to pay compensation and also to help relocate abroad family members and Afghans working for Nutrition and Education International, NEI, but that remains stuck on determining just who is qualified.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.